Wrapping up a pretty busy week and a busy month, Friday, June 28, 2024 on Connecticut Today. I opened with my thoughts and some takeaways from the previous night's debate between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. We also featured analysis from former Time Magazine senior reporter Alan Sanders. Our author spotlight this week featured Randall Woods. He talked about his new book, John Quincy Adams, A Man for the Whole People. Quinnipiac University law professor Wayne Unger stopped by to summarize the busy last few days of the current U.S. Supreme Court term, while former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso dropped by with his weekly update.
So I don't understand or I don't realize why so many people, at least if you believe the Democratic Party or liberal or progressive pundits that you heard from last night after the debate, I don't understand why they suddenly seem so surprised. I mean, my God, you watched these people last night on CNN and on MSNBC and PBS and NPR and all the left-leaning outlets, and they all sound like their puppy just died. Well, your puppy wasn't doing well to begin with. I'm sitting here and watching this, and man, after that debate, it was like somebody flipped a light switch. And here's my question. Were they not paying attention over the past year or so? Honestly. Because one of two things, either they weren't paying attention and were willfully blind as to what was going on, or they were paying attention, but they didn't want to say anything. Mind-boggling. Look, I feel bad for Joe Biden. I do. I didn't catch the beginning of the debate. I was running around, but, you know, I flipped it on in my car listening here on WICC, and I heard the first 5 or 10 minutes, and I said to myself, wait a minute, I thought he was holed up at Camp David practicing. Since when? Last weekend? He practiced? What did he practice? And please, I don't want to hear he had a cold. When the White House came out during that debate last night and said, well, the president has a cold, stop it. The hoarse voice, the squinting of the eyes, that's been around for a year and change right now. And I mean, I honestly feel bad for the guy. Can we just agree on something? Nobody who is 81 years old should be running for president. Why is that so hard to understand? Why is that? And then they came back from, again, as I mentioned, you know, all the liberal pundits, CNN, MSNBC. I'm watching some of that last night and this morning. And I'm watching it and I'm like, you can't be surprised. Maybe they are. Maybe they actually bought into the notion. Every time there was a bad looking for him Biden video, with all due respect to Mr. Biden, every time one of those videos was put up, what did we hear from the White House? What did we hear from the DNC? Oh, that's not the president. That's an AI deepfake. No, it's not. It's not about D versus R. It's not really about Trump versus Biden. It's not about left versus right. It's about nominating somebody from one of the major parties who is a bit more up for the job. I'm sorry. I know what he says. He said today in Philadelphia. He was in North Carolina. I'm sorry. I may be a little old, but I can do this. No. No. No, there's a reason nobody's flying an airliner at 81 years old. There's a reason nobody's doing heart surgery at 81 years old. There's a reason you don't have military commanders, 5-star generals and all, although there's only been a few of them, who are 81 years old. mind-boggling. And let me ask you another question here. And by the way, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Last night on the debate, 203-333-9422. 333-WICC, 333-9422. Put a 203 in front of it. What do you think they were saying today and when morning rose and the sun rose in Beijing? You don't think Xi Jinping, the leader of China and the CCP, the China Communist Party, you don't think they were watching that last night and saying, oh, dear God, look at this? You don't think Vladimir Putin was watching this with his cronies at the Kremlin and having a nice glass of vodka or two, tossing a couple down and laughing at this? My God. And listen, this doesn't mean that Trump was great, too, because he dishes out stuff that he knows isn't true. But, man, you know what that looked like last night? And I said this to a friend of mine. Those of you who are old enough, probably about my age, late 50s, early 60s, do you remember in the early 1980s? This was the first thought that came to my mind. Various other thoughts did, but this is the first one that came to my mind. Back about 1980-something, 86, 87, 88, when Mike Tyson was just destroying everything and everyone in his way in the heavyweight division. He was mowing guys down. The faster you could stand them up, he was mowing them down like bowling pins. There was a fight between Mike Tyson, you remember this, and Michael Spinks, right? Tyson v. Spinks, and everybody said, remember, oh, Michael Spinks is the guy. He's going to take down Tyson. Tyson's not that good. And a lot of people said, well, you know, Michael Spinks is a puffed-up middleweight. Tyson, nah, this is going to be Tyson's match. The fight ended, what, in 50-something seconds? Seriously. It may have been a minute and change into the round. That's the only thing I thought about last night. The big buildup, you know, Tyson is Trump, and you know, and Michael Spinks, you know, he's the guy that's going to finally take down Trump, Joe Biden, and oh my God, a couple of rights, and it was over. It was done. And please. Kamala Harris and everybody, and they're spinning it well. He did better in the second half of the debate. Really? That's like, you hear some of these idiot pitchers saying, yeah, well, I wasn't good the first three innings, but I finally got my fastball in the fourth inning. Yeah, but you were down 8-0 when you got your fastball, like Carlos Rodon last night with the Yankees. Well, I was feeling good, too. That's great, Carlos, when you were down 8-0. My God. Don't tell us that all of a sudden there's a notion that now they have to replace it, and he's not going to go anywhere. We'll get into why in a minute, but he's not going to go anywhere now. He may go after the convention, but man, oh man, why is anybody surprised with this? Maybe there were some Biden supporters, some Democrats who actually said, well, he'll do well because he was holed up at Camp David since, what, last Friday or last Saturday? Apparently, it didn't do much. And again, you can separate out being old or being elderly from, you know, just rambling and saying stuff. Incoherency. It wasn't about age last night. It wasn't about being hoarse from a supposed cold. It was about being incoherent. My God. And look, I don't know what the Biden family dynamic is, but it's a little odd. We all know it's been hit by tragedy. You hear stories about weird things in the relationship of that family. They can't. They can't. Well, maybe they can. Maybe they're going to say, screw this. We're not pulling them out. I don't know. But he's the one that's eventually got to let loose here, if he wants to. Oh, and by the way, one member of the House is finally floating something that was floated against Trump. Remember the 25th Amendment? In fact, years ago, I interviewed the gentleman who actually helped write the 26th Amendment. 25th, I'm sorry. And remember, every time Trump farted the wrong way, every time he broke wind the wrong way, 25th Amendment, get rid of him. Well, now somebody is finally saying, listen, Kamala Harris needs to be the president. Right? Started off today with Todd and Shelton. Todd, what's up with you?
How you doing, Mr. Pacelli? You're doing a phenomenal job.
Thank you, Todd. What's up?
I think Donald John Trump won that first debate, and I think he's going to win the election. Common sense will steer you in that direction.
Well, you know what, Todd? And Todd, thank you for the call. Listen, you don't know whether Trump won or not, he was certainly more with it than Joe Biden. And thanks once again, Todd. And if you're a member of the Chinese government or of the Russian government, and you're saying to yourself, well, do we want to deal with Trump or with Biden? Who do you think they want to deal with? Well, look, they're probably laughing when they look at Biden, and they're probably going, when they look at Trump. They don't like unpredictability. Dave and Meriden. Dave, what's up with you?
Hey, good afternoon, Paul. Hey, I remember that Sphinx fight. Boy, anybody that did the pay-per-view for that was going to get their money's
worth. That was like last night. It was like a minute. That was it. David's the first thing I thought of. Michael Sphinx getting hammered by Mike Tyson.
Oh, yeah. But, I was watching the debate about the first hour of it, and then I was surprised that it didn't happen sooner, but about 7 or 8 minutes is when Biden started babbling incoherently and couldn't complete a thought. And it was, downhill after that.
Yeah.
He definitely doesn't have the capability anymore to be a leader.
And Dave, thank you. And that doesn't make him a bad person. But like I say, there's certain things an 81-year-old person shouldn't do. Look, he can teach college. Wasn't he teaching a course in the off years? He can go on the lecture circuit. He can give interviews. That's fine. But there comes a time. Now, there are different scenarios. Now, I don't think he's going to walk away, but as has been explained by our midday host, Eric Erickson, and other folks, probably reasons that better suit the Democratic Party if he doesn't drop out yet. And we'll explain that coming up. Linda's in Bridgeport. Linda, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul. It's Linda, the House Servant.
Yes, yes.
Yes, you asked me to give you the lowdown on the debate, which I watched the whole thing.
Oh, bless you. Yes, yes.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
They were both mudslinging at each other. Very, very bad for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Biden was the worst. The worst comment he made was Trump was having sex with Stormy Daniels when his wife was pregnant. Okay.
Yes.
that was the worst of them. But for people who don't know, and I watch everything. I watched a video on Bill Maher, and Bill Maher had Stormy Daniels on his show. And he asked her, did you have sex with Trump? And she said, no.
Yes, that's a
not.
Famous video. And Linda, I do have to run. Thank you. Yes, that popped up a few weeks ago. Linda, good on you, because I did watch that and I did make a note of it. Yeah, Stormy Daniels a couple of years back with Bill Maher. No, I didn't have sex with Donald Trump. How was that not introduced into evidence in the case? Continuing your reaction to and our analysis of our first look at the candidates one-on-one in the debate cycle for the 2024 White House race. Last night, President Biden versus former President Donald Trump. Joining us now to add his insights, one of my favorite go-to guys, a former Time Magazine senior reporter. He's an attorney and a professor emeritus of political science at the St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey, Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, it's Paul here again. How are you, sir?
Very good, Paul. Very well, and I hope you're well, too.
I am. Thank you, sir. Well, not getting into parsing what we all saw last night. It's been several hours since then, so that has been sliced and diced. So let's get into this. What are Democrats thinking right now? And, Professor, despite what they say, Are the wheels in some way, shape, in your experience, you've covered this stuff, is there any motion toward, okay, maybe we need a plan B here, or maybe not?
Well, certainly there's going to be discussion about a plan B. There's going to be lots of phone calls and lots of behind-the-scenes discussions. But the reality is that if you switch horses in midstream, you're asking for chaos. It's not clear that the Democrats would unify behind someone else. There might be a contest of some sort at the convention. None of that works to the benefit of the Democratic Party or whoever emerges as the nominee. What's interesting is that Biden had a rally earlier today in North Carolina, and he was the feisty, aggressive, totally in control person that one expected to see last night. So a lot of people are asking, so where was that Joe Biden last night? Why didn't he behave in the way he behaved earlier today in North Carolina? I think the odds are stronger that he will remain the nominee. There's a lot of damage control that needs to be done. You already see it by the elected officials. They're all rallying behind Biden, saying that the performance that counts is not the performance of a debate, but the performance in office. And they're citing all the achievements and the objectives that the president has set out for himself, some of them achieved, some of them to be achieved if he gets a second term. But clearly the Democrats are upset. There is panic. But, you know, you have to wait until the dust settles about a week from now to see how people now view what needs to be done going forward. So I think we need to get a little calm period. Whether we'll get it or not, we'll have to see.
Yeah.
But at least within the Biden ranks, I think they want to assess, you know, in about a week. So where do things look, really? How damaging is this? And how much of this will be remembered by people in what is now going to be a very long campaign until November?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I did read and hear, Professor, that if this were to happen, if for some reason, somehow, we had a different Democratic nominee, did I understand it that it's far easier to do that after the convention? Because as you say, if the president releases his delegates, then the risk is, although it'd be fun to watch for guys like you and me, the risk of a brokered convention would be a risk of chaos in an atmosphere where we already have things like, you know, the environmental crowd, DEI, Israel and Hamas, the border and things like that. Did I hear correctly that if he were to step out after the Democratic convention in Chicago, there is kind of an internal process that could replace him?
You know, I don't know about that, Paul. I'm not sure what that process would be. But whatever it would be, it would still allow for the various factions of the Democratic Party to push for whatever candidate they believe would be the best choice. I mean, if Biden were to step out, the obvious thing for Biden to do would be to throw his support behind somebody, presumably his vice president, you know, Vice President Harris. But that's not necessarily what he might do. But that might possibly unify the party. But nonetheless, you know, switching in midstream is highly problematic because it brings out all the divisions and all of the peculiarities of the various people at a moment in time when you really want to be unified. So my guess is that the Democrats will stick with the horse they've got. It's a damaged horse as a result of the debate last night. Certainly, we're all talking about it, and it's going to be big news for the next few days. But it may quiet down, and if it does quiet down, and if Biden regains his stride, as he seems to have done earlier today, it may just be yet another problem, but not necessarily a crisis.
And
we'll
have
to see.
Yeah, and if he were, if there's any change this late, Professor, in a campaign like this, you know, the question is of money and technicalities, and I mean, I don't know what the law is, but if somebody drops out, you know, where does their campaign cash go? Who's raising it? What do the PACs do? I mean, again, we seem to forget, a lot of people do, you and I don't, that money is the mother's milk of all this thing, of this whole thing.
That's right. And so what one needs to see is not just what the officials say publicly, Democratic officials elected or appointed, but also where the donors are going to go and what are they saying in their phone conversations with the campaign. So we need to take a look at the donors. Another important element here at stake is what are foreign governments thinking? I mean, mm-hmm. we always tend to think of our president, you know, in mostly domestic terms, and that's appropriate, of course. But there are foreign governments who look to the United States for their security, for their support. And so I would be interested to see if there's any reporting on what foreign governments are saying or doing, and what are they saying privately to their American ambassadors or to the State Department about what they saw last night. Because if you're Ukraine, if you're Israel, if you're the countries of NATO, I think there was ground for concern there for them as well as for us domestically in the U.S. So that's another point of concern that the Democrats need to address.
Professor Emeritus Alan Sanders, the guest and oftentimes contributor to this program and all things political. I thought, Professor, the rules last night were excellent with no audience, with the microphones being muted for the person who was not answering. And I thought the moderators did a good job. So I thought the mechanics of the debate were absolutely pretty good.
Well, I would agree only partially on that, Paul.
Okay.
I think the mechanics, that is to say, silencing the mic and not having an audience, we don't need cheerleaders. People can assess for their themselves what the candidates are saying. We don't need cheerleaders clapping or booing or doing anything. That's a distraction, and I think it's good to turn off the mic. But I was severely disappointed by the moderators for one very simple reason. Trump kept saying all kinds of falsehoods. I mean, it's been demonstrated by the various analysts and various commentators. I don't need to go through all of the falsehoods or exaggerations. And the moderators did not press Trump. They simply let him speak without being challenged. Now, of course, it is the responsibility of the opponent, Mr. Biden, to have addressed those as well. But I think moderators have also a responsibility to not just ask questions, but to keep asking questions if they're not being answered. I mean, we saw that President Trump did issue falsehood, but he also didn't answer the questions. It was only at the end, towards the end of the debate, that the moderator said, but Mr. President, the question was, you know, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of the debate, he did not address the question directly, and I think the moderators let him off a little too easily on that.
Do you think there's a fear then, Professor, that, and we can't get into whomever moderates these things, and I've done debates on a very, very low level, you know, statewide and
right.
townwide around here, but you think there's a fear that, no, listen, people know he exaggerates. Let's not give him more microphone time, maybe out of a fear of the other camp saying, hey, you gave him, you know how this works, three times the time you gave us to answer that question. Do you think there might be a fear of that or not?
Well, there might be a fear of that, and it might be difficult on the spot to sort of counter whatever claim a candidate is making and say that's not true. I mean, that's a difficult thing for a moderator to do. But what you can do and what moderators should do is to, if there's a time left, or even if there isn't time left, but sir, you did not answer the question was, and repeat the question. And even if there's no further time for the person to answer the question, I think the person needs to be reminded that he or she did not answer the question. And I think viewers would respect that, because they would say, okay, he spoke about whatever he spoke, but he didn't answer the question, so why didn't he answer the question? Because it probably was a difficult question to answer. I think moderators can do that, and they should do that.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, madam, you did not answer the question. I think that's a fair response from moderators, without having to get into whether the response was flawed or false or misleading or whatever. You didn't answer the question.
As you say, it'll take about a week probably, and I've heard that from you and other people. Let's let the polls settle in for a week. In the end, do you think this moves a lot of voters or not? Is this just a kind of a sideshow that we're used to right now?
Well, probably not. That is to say, debates in general simply tend to confirm people's views about the candidates before they even heard what the debate was all about. So I suspect Trump supporters are still Trump supporters. Biden supporters are still Biden supporters. But what's at stake here is that small slice of undecided voters and also the enthusiasm gap. A lot of people, you know, or I should say a lot of campaigns, want their candidates to generate enthusiasm so that people go to the polls. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it changes the views of people, but it might affect people's enthusiasm for going to vote for Trump or going to vote for Biden. And since this election is going to be very close, if people are not enthusiastic about a candidate, in this case possibly Joe Biden, I think Democrats are worried about that. They're not worried that Biden supporters are all of a sudden going to say, okay, we support Donald Trump. They're just worried that they might choose to stay home.
Attorney, former Time Magazine senior reporter, and currently professor emeritus, political science at St. Peter's University in Jersey City, New Jersey. Always good to get the thoughts and opinions of Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, good to chat with you, and I'm sure we'll be chatting down the line. Thank you, and have a happy weekend.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Paul. Take care.
Take care. All right, there you go. The John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas. He's taught there since 1971. Previous books include LBJ, Architect of American Ambition, and Fulbright, a biography that won the Robert H. Farrell Prize. The new book is the book about the sixth president of the United States, son of the second president, John Quincy Adams, a man for the whole people, and we welcome Randall Woods to the program. Hey, Randall, it's Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm good.
Thanks.
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for taking the time. A man for the whole people. What does that mean? I mean, I had a cursory knowledge of John Quincy Adams. You go into it deeply here, and the book is getting rave reviews. Why do you designate him a man for the whole people?
It comes from a quote that he said about himself and his political career. He said, "I would feign, that is, attempt to be a man for the whole people." He and his father really hoped to govern above partisan strife, above political parties. Quincy Adams, in particular, who was in public service for 47 out of his 81 years, was committed above all else to union. I mean, he was the sixth president, but he's probably better known as being America's greatest Secretary of State. He concluded the Transcontinental Treaty, which extended American boundaries to the Pacific. He was the driving force behind the Monroe Doctrine. What I found him particularly interesting was after he was defeated by Andrew Jackson in 1824, mm-hmm. In 1828, he was elected to Congress, and he served in Congress for 17 years. He's the only ex-president to do that. And during that period, he was the scourge of the slave power. He introduced constitutional amendments to do away with the three-fifths clause, mm-hmm. to emancipate the slaves. He was listened to throughout the Union. He was an iconic figure because he was a link to the founding fathers.
His opposition to slavery, Randall, was that out of political expediency, or did he just believe that in his heart that the owning of one human being and the indentured servitude of one human being for another was just morally wrong?
Very much the latter. His mother's father had owned two slaves. They were in Braintree and Quincy in Massachusetts, but they were personally, morally opposed to slavery. And so he inherited that feeling. He thought it was an abomination, a contradiction of the Declaration of Independence, and very much against his Congregationalist religious views.
How alike, Randall, or dislike was he to his father, John Adams, the second president of the U.S.? As men growing up and maturing, were there connections that made them kind of the same person, and at the same time, were they divergent on things, if such?
Well, I think that they were as close as father and son could be. John Quincy, when he was 11, with him to France in 1778 when he was overseeing the Franco-American Treaty during the American Revolution. And he would remain there, John and John Quincy would remain there until John Quincy was 18 years old. John took him for really emotional support. They were, again, as close as father and son could be. They were intellectual soulmates. Both of them were multilingual.
Mm-hmm.
Their ideas were, I think that John Quincy Adams was an extension of his father, who was, member of the Continental Congress, one of the architects of the Constitution. John was more concerned with how to construct a viable government and a republic.
Hmm.
John Quincy was obsessed with preserving the Union.
Obviously, different eras. The name of the book, John Quincy Adams, A Man for the Whole People, hardcover. It came out a couple of days ago, this week, June 25th. Randall Woods is the author. Randall, how difficult is it to write a book like this, especially about historic figures where, at least from a dummy like me, when I look at names like John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, and I see more and more books coming out, I'm saying to myself, wow, are we unearthing more stuff about these people that we didn't know? I find it fascinating that folks like you write these great books. How difficult is that? And do you discover stuff in the process? Like, you know, your book about LBJ. Do you discover stuff in the process that was overlooked in some way, shape, or form?
Well, I hope so. It took me 7 years to finish the project. The plus and minus is that there's a huge amount of material because John Quincy Adams has a 7,000-page diary, which is considered one of the greatest diaries in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
His mother and father, John and Abigail, and his wife, Louisa, together wrote over 2,000 letters. So if you have the patience to go through these things and to put their lives and the events they were involved in context, yeah, you're going to discover new things. It's a family history. I mean, this is the Adams family.
Yeah.
And it was very fraught. They were highly intelligent, very intense. Alcoholism plagued the family.
Really?
Abigail's brother died of alcoholism.
Wow.
Both of John Quincy's brothers died of alcoholism. One of his sons died of alcoholism, and another committed suicide. So this is a very intense family, and I think an interesting one from a biographer's point of view.
Randall, how did you get access to those letters and diaries? Who has them, and how does somebody get access to that? And what was it like going through those pages and reading those letters, you know, from a couple of hundred years ago?
Well, most of the material is in the Massachusetts Historical Society or in the Huntington Library in California or in the National Archives.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty, some of them have been transcribed, but many have not. So the difficulty was reading them in their original handwriting.
Yeah.
I do believe that Abigail Adams has the worst handwriting of any human being.
Really?
I have ever.
Really?
Because very intelligent.
Yeah, it's funny because
no, I mean,
you look at writing from that era, and oftentimes it's so incredibly, you know, fluid and the spacing
right.
is perfect.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, people don't do that anymore. But I guess somebody was sloppy back then, too.
Huh? they were. And you need to, if you're going to understand them, you've got to understand their friends, who they're associated with. I mean, the Adams knew every prominent American and most prominent Europeans during their lifetime. And so there's that aspect. They provide you insight into, for example, what's the politics in Britain and France, Prussia. But the people who they associated with wrote about the Adams as well. And that's often invaluable.
And people of that ilk, of that social stature, John Adams and John Quincy and Abigail, I would imagine they had, Randall, an understanding and an insight that just many Americans at that time just didn't, right? Because of their connections.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. No, because of their education and Abigail's instance, self-education,
mm-hmm.
because of their education, because of their linguistic skills, because of their political connect and social connections, they knew more about their world, the world in which they lived in, than most other Americans.
Mm.
A handful like Thomas Jefferson, but they were very unusual.
Randall, final question here. I'm going to throw you a little curveball here from Connecticut.
All right.
If John Quincy Adams was providing analysis of the debate last night, what do you think the great John Quincy Adams would have? What would his take of that have been?
Well, he was Quincy Adams was a master orator, a rhetorician, professor of rhetoric at Harvard. He was the 19th century was an era of orators,
mm-hmm.
and he would, of course, have been appalled from a number of points of view in terms of the so-called debate, which it was really not. But his idea. His fundamental idea, what he would say if he could say it to people, was that America is a republic and it is one people. And that oneness, that sense of community, it should transcend everything else. If it does not, then the republic will not survive.
The name of the book, folks, pick it up. It just came out this week, especially if you're a historian. You love good books like this, and the reviews have been fabulous. John Quincy Adams, A Man for the Whole People, in hardcover. Check it out, Amazon or your local bookstore. Randall Woods, the guest. Randall, thank you. Congratulations, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Randall Woods there, professor at the University of Arkansas since the early 70s. John Quincy Adams, A Man for the Whole People. Back here with you on a jam-packed Friday edition of Connecticut Today right here on WICC. A lot of buzz about what the Supreme Court has been saying really over the past couple of weeks. A lot of key rulings coming down over the past few days. And to analyze some of those, assistant professor of law at Quinnipiac University, the QU Law School, Professor Wayne Unger is with us. Hey, Wayne, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing well, Paul. Thank you for having me back once again.
Great to have you. Thanks for taking the time. Well, there's literally a menu list of really big cases, Wayne. So, you know, I'll let you lead it off here of the stuff that we've heard about over the past 3 or 4 days or so. Illustrate some of the big ones here that some of my listeners may be interested in.
Oh, well, that's a big question there, Paul. So there have been some blockbuster cases just this week alone, but over the last two, maybe 3 weeks. Earlier today, the Supreme Court overturned a case that was about 40, maybe 50 years old, which is generally referred to as the Chevron case. And the Chevron case created something called the Chevron deference test, which tasked the federal courts with deferring to administrative agencies. So agencies like the SEC and the FTC,
mm-hmm.
Deferring to their interpretation of their own rules and regulations. And so today, with today's decision, they brought the power back to the courts to do that interpretation and not give the deference to whatever the interpretation is according to those administrative agencies. So that was a big one. That will fundamentally shift what we say is administrative law. And then there was the First Amendment misinformation case where there was an accusation, really, that the Biden administration early in the pandemic compelled social media platforms to remove misinformation related to the pandemic and the vaccine, when in fact all they did was ask. So asking is different from compulsion and different from coercion. And the Supreme Court said that the states who filed suit in that case did not have what's called Article III standing, meaning that they did not have a sufficient injury to bring the case in the first place. So the court just outright dismissed that case. So those are just two, but there are many more, Paul.
Yeah, and one that was fascinating to me, U.S. v. Rahimi, the court ruling that governments can disarm individuals, Wayne, that are being held or subject to domestic abuse restraining orders. And I know this was a big contention. I would get calls on the show here from a lot of gun advocates wondering about this. But I guess the court ruled that that is a reasonable, you know, as wide open as the Second Amendment is, that is a reasonable precaution that they can do.
Right. And so what was a little surprising about this case, in my opinion, was the 8-1 outcome. The lone dissenter in this case was Justice Thomas. And the majority of the court, eight of the other justices, concluded that it is lawful or constitutional for governments to disarm individuals who may be in possession or ownership of firearms when they're subject to a domestic abuse temporary restraining order or permanent restraining order. And this is surprising because the court over the last 10, 15 maybe years has ruled heavily in favor of broadening and kind of giving less restrictions to gun rights and broadening the Second Amendment rights to allow for more gun possession and allow for more carrying in public, for example. So this, it was a little surprising because in a way it was counterintuitive for where the court has been heading over the last 10 to 15 years on the Second Amendment.
It is refreshing, Wayne, as you mentioned, when we do get, you know, surprising results or, you know, the kind of relationships that people think on the court are impossible where, you know, everything isn't, you know, in past days 5-4 or 6-3. Sometimes you have cases, and we see a couple here, that kind of transcend the liberal or straight progressive or straight conservative leanings of some of these justices. And frankly, I don't know about you, I think that's a little refreshing.
Oh, for sure it is. It's a little a bit of a misnomer or misconception that the court is always, you know, split along these ideological lines. Now, don't get me wrong. It is. And there are some cases that come down the traditional, in our case, 6-3 with the conservatives in the majority. Mm-hmm. But the majority of the cases are either unanimous or a mix of ideologies. Mm-hmm. So we'll see justices swing across the board. Justice Thomas has joined the liberals on occasion. Justice Alito has joined the liberals on occasion. Justice Barrett, in a ruling today, joined the liberals. And Justice Jackson, the newest justice on the court appointed by President Biden, joined the conservatives in that same case today. So it is actually, I would say, more common than not that the court is not split on this ideological 6-3 under the present court. And more often than not, it is a mix or it's unanimous.
And finally, Wayne, we still have not heard about what the court thinks about what could be the most contentious case in the body politic, the immunity case revolving around former President Donald Trump. What are the particulars of that? And maybe it looks like it's coming next week. What's the update on that?
This case is about whether the president of the United States has absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for any official acts done while in office. Now, of course, this has come up because President Trump has been indicted on acts related to or conduct related to January 6th. And it's been alleged that he has committed several crimes in relation to January 6th. So he's making the argument that, number one, they were official acts done in the Oval Office, essentially under the seal of the presidency. And then two, because they're official acts, he should have absolute immunity. Now, when he says absolute, that means, right, in practicality, he can't, or the president of the United States cannot be held criminally liable for any crime because it's an absolute immunity. And so the justices, I think, find a little skepticism in the absolute argument, and rightfully so, because if it was absolute immunity, that would mean that the president could, in theory, grab a firearm, shoot and kill somebody as an official act of the president, and then of course, not be criminally charged with murder. So I think the reasonable outcome here that to expect is that the court will find some level of immunity, so qualified immunity, but I would be flabbergasted, Paul, if they agree in full with Donald Trump that the president deserves absolute criminal immunity. But one thing to keep in mind, and this is my last thought on this point, is that whatever the court decides, right, applies to the office of the presidency and not to any particular individual. So that would mean President Biden would be a beneficiary of whatever the court decides. And I think many people don't realize that component, right? It applies to the office regardless of which political party has the office. So it will be an intriguing couple of months ahead before the general election.
Great stuff. Great analysis. Assistant Professor of Law, the Quinnipiac University Law School, Professor Wayne Unger. Wayne, thank you as always. Great analysis, and we'll chat down the road, sir. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks, Paul.
Our next guest, our regular Friday 5:15 guy, Chris Caruso. You can find them all and more of the podcast at our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600. Speaking of, Mr. Caruso, he's here. Chris, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Chris. Chris, I have a question for you. Do you think the Biden campaign was breaking out the Brioski last night after...
I think they were. You know, I support the president, Biden, but he really did a poor job last night in the debate. And, you know, Trump benefited by it. You know, I've been in a few debates myself.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought.
I thought it started off very slow on Biden's part. I don't think he was feeling well. You could hear the raspiness of his voice. Mm-hmm. And I think it just, you know, it seemed to pick up a little bit better as time went on, but not enough. You know, when you're in a debate with an opponent and the opponent says something, you know, you have to be able to go back and state different facts in order to, you know, put in doubt what your opponent has said. And Biden wasn't able to do that last night. And so I think on Biden's part, it was a poor performance. You know, I'll be very honest, though. I think Trump lied throughout the entire performance as well. He was making things up and had the benefit of Biden not challenging him. So I think when all was said and done, do I think the debate is going to make a huge difference? I don't think so. But, hey, it just, you know, kind of underscored what people have been saying about, unfortunately, you know, Biden's age and, you know, his ability to debate. And I think that came out clearly last night. But that was my take on it. I also think they probably prepped him far too much.
Yeah.
You know, a whole week, and they just kept, you know, feeding him facts and information. After a while, there's only so much the mind, even a younger person, can absorb and then be able to, you know, speak out when the time comes. And I've been in debate preps, and, you know, and sometimes you just got to give the person a couple of days off just to kind of digest everything, absorb it, take some time just to rest. And I think that's critical. I remember at one time I won the state of Connecticut oratorical contest. It was in Waterbury, and challenged probably about 10 people. And we had to, you have to memorize a part of the speech. It's 11 minutes you had to memorize, and I did. But, you know, it was something that, you know, I just needed time, really just a quiet time before this presentation. Because if I didn't, I knew as I went along, you know, I would just, you know, fumble somewhere. So I think sometimes over-prepping a person isn't the best thing either.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, give them the information and give them some time to absorb it. But overall, I think that's where it is. You know, I think I've mentioned to you before on the show that I don't know if Biden is actually going to be the Democratic candidate.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. And they're talking today about, well, you've got to use the fulcrum here as the convention. Yep. And if he releases his delegates before the convention, that's different, Chris, than getting the nomination and then saying, hey, thanks for the nomination. I can't do that. And then I guess it goes to an inner circle of people. So it's either the before or after the convention that's key here, from what I read.
you know, I think you're right. And the other side is, you know, Joe Biden has to be willing to step aside. And I think you have to be careful with that. You don't want to put too much pressure where he's going to say no. But, you know, I think from the beginning, I questioned whether he was going to run or not. I think he, you know, made it clear that he was going to hold that spot open. And, you know, whenever an incumbent president announces that they're not going to run again for a second term, they become a lame duck.
Lame duck,
and right. Their ability to negotiate is very weakened, and you know, the Congress doesn't take them as seriously. So I think, you know, it was a holding place, and as time goes on, you may see something happen. But I think it's going to be carefully done, because I don't think you can do it quickly. I think you've got to line up who the candidate will be, and then a vice presidential candidate, and do it as a package deal. The other thing is, the one good thing for the Democrats is the convention is late in August, which is unusual, but it gives them more time to do it. And the other thing is, you're going to see Biden in the next couple of weeks or so, how he does on the campaign trail. You know, I think the polling is going to have some effect to see if the debates did have a negative effect overall. You know, they hit a little bit, I'm sure, but is it enough to, you know, turn against them? We'll have to wait and see. But I think a lot of things have to be considered. You have the vice president, Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
You know, does she become the candidate or not? You know, those are all things that have to be worked through and carefully worked through. But, you know, I think it's in play, I guess, is what, you know, my thought of it is. And there's a lot of great candidates out there, Paul. I was watching this morning Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania. Let me tell you, very sharp on his feet.
You have him, Chris. You have Andy Beshear in Kentucky. I mean, here you have guys, and what's the key, Chris? Yeah. They're moderates. They're not real left-wing Democrats.
No.
Here. Yes.
That's, you know, Paul, you hit it right on the head. I've always tried to look at things based on common sense, what was the right move on different issues for people, you know, what was going to benefit people the most. And, you know, there were times to be honest with you, I voted on things that were probably more liberal than but I thought they were in the right path for people. But for the most part, I think, you know, you're right. I think it's going to be the middle of the country that's going to decide this race. And what's interesting, what most polling is showing, is that elder voters, you know, older voters are the ones who are probably going to decide this.
Yeah.
And most of them are in the middle. They're the ones that are more moderate. You saw what just happened in Westchester, right? With
Vladimir Bowman
winning, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's where the country is. You know, we sit back and a lot of Democrats criticize Bill Clinton, but he had the best strategy. He was in the center.
Well, it's that triangulation, remember? And I've had Dick Morris on this program. And you see, and it's very simple, Chris. It's a triangle. The point of the triangle is above the fray, and you position yourself slightly to the right of the left and slightly to the left of the right. And there you go. Let me tell you, Chris, in this category, in this age, Bill Clinton would be a liberal Republican. I'm telling you, he would be.
Paul, you're 100% right. Let me tell you, when he did reform on welfare, for example, that was like the third rail of the Democrats, you know. But he reformed that. There was issues with the economy he made changes to. And it was just, you know, I think people were more accepting or looking for the middle. And I think he realized that. And I think that's what's going to – this race is going to be in the middle, you know. And I think if it's too far right or too far left, I just don't think it's going to work.
No.
And last night was just an indicator of that, you know. I think many people are still going to vote for Biden. I don't think it's a done deal at this point. But we've got to watch it. And I talked to a group today, you know, some of Trump's comments, though, about – you know, things he said, and then later said, "Well, no, I didn't say that. That wasn't said." You know, and Biden just never, you know, caught him on that. The immigration would have been a great opportunity for Biden just to say, "Hey, listen, we had a bipartisan bill in the Senate. It was crafted by one of the most conservative senators in the country, And, you know, Donald, you spoke against
him. And I was shocked. Yeah, Chris, I was shocked you didn't go at him on that. In about the 2 minutes we have left, I do want to get your we had a special session, Chris. And in the special session, which was supposed to be, you know, just technical fixes. Don't worry about it. Nothing. And then all of a sudden, we're going to have a vote on possibly selling Aquarian Water. And then all of a sudden, we have a vote also in that bill, Chris, on changing the car tax. I mean, this, these are the, and again, Chris, you and I are the same way on this. It's not the policies. It's how we debate them or we don't.
Oh, absolutely, Paul. You know, an Aquarian Water Company serves so many people in this state, a huge customer base. And, you know, people are concerned now if this water authority takes over, what's going to happen to the rates? And in some cases, they will not fall under PURA, which is the regulatory agency. So that's another concern. I guess what this bill does is allow them to bid on the possible purchase of Aquarion. But it's not a done deal because it still has to go to the state regulators and so forth. But you know, it could be pretty much a done deal. And I think the ratepayers are very concerned, especially the ones in the Aquarion, you know, network. There should have been a public hearing. It should have been properly vetted. If there was nothing to hide, put it before the public. And, and you know, have your debate, have your disagreements, have it looked at, and then do a clean vote on it. You know, it was also in the bill that people didn't know that, you know, at the last legislative session, I was telling you where that if you had a company that was overseeing a construction project on schools, they could also bid on the subcontractor work. Well, in this bill, that was reversed. So thank God they did that in the sense that now a person over a company overseeing other companies can't bid on similar work. So I thought that was a positive in that bill. As far as the car tax, apparently it was a glitch that they didn't correct before and would have increased the property tax on commercial vehicles. So they made the change there, I think, you know, which made sense. But again, a lot of this criticism and attacks and everything else could be so avoided if they just, like you say, follow the process, have a hearing, vet the bill, and where it goes, you know.
Absolutely. Chris, as always, great stuff to wrap up the week. Thank you, sir. Stay safe, drive safe, and we'll chat next week.
Yes, happy 4th of July, Paul.
Yes, and Chris, avoid the guy in the neighborhood that you and I always knew who had like a warehouse of armaments in his house for 4th of July, right? Every Italian neighborhood, there was one guy, right? Right?
Yeah, the chooch, Paul. The chooch.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate
it. Take care, Paul.
All right, yes. Folks, right, coming up on July 4th next week, right, there was that one guy. In the neighborhood, yeah, I got a guy, and he's got, you open up his garage, and it looks like a munitions depot. As Chris says, a chooch.